Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, joined today again by Texas Politics Project Research Director Josh Blank. Another happy summer day to you.
It's a great day.
It's a great day. A little skunky out there.
Yeah, but you know, it's been a nice summer so far. You know, it's been wet, but it hasn't been too hot. You know, the grass is green. I'm taking it. You know,
well,
it's
that's a good attitude.
Yeah,
good attitude.
I try.
Well, there are a few things going on today. I mean, we were talking before we went on. We could have, I suppose, focused on the GOP convention this weekend.
Could have. Yeah. But
that's not going anywhere, I suppose. And we'll see. There's an interesting trajectory of the state conventions. Yeah. When they matter, when they don't, how much they matter, you know, et cetera. I mean, I would say there's – when they come up, it's always a focus of attention in the press anyway.
Yeah.
Which I suspect has to do with the travel opportunities and, you know,
well, it's hard.
The gathering of the whole thing. But there's also – you know, not to be too cynical about that. I mean – and there are interesting things going on in terms of shifting roles of parties we were talking
about. Yeah, no, I mean, it's hard to argue that it's not important, but the way that it's important usually is less so, in my my experience watching, less so about something that happens like in a really newsy way at the convention, more so like, you know, what kind of traps get laid for later is what I think about. You know, what markers are sort of, is the party organization made up of a lot of really engaged people going to put out as sort of the expectations for the party going into 2027. And that kind of stuff is like, but that takes a little time to mature, I think, a lot of the times. So we'll see. Maybe somebody will get booed. You know, that could be interesting.
Well, and I think kind of in the, you know, over the longer arc of these conventions, I mean, there is something interesting to be noted about whether the role those conventions used to play and then the role that they played for a while when the corporate sponsors pulled out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's a discussion to be had about the way that I think for a long time those conventions would happen. They were taken as markers. This platform got put together, platforms routinely ignored.
Right.
But now as the, you know, particularly on the Republican side, as the party apparatus has become more aggressive, there's been more enforcement efforts, these things about using the party to change the primary rules, blah, you know.
Or even bar people from the primary ballot.
Yeah, to censure members and all of this, which is all relatively new.
Yeah.
And so there's probably something there.
Yeah.
You know, which should make it maybe more interesting than it used to be.
Yeah, it certainly was.
To some degree.
Well, I think that's the right
context. You know, having gone to a couple of them, I mean, it's an interesting experience.
But that's the right context, I think, you know, for watching this, you know, in addition to sort of the trap lamb, I think that's the better point, is to say that, you know, there has been an evolution over the last 5 to 10 years, let's say.
Yeah, I think that's probably about the right time frame.
Where the party organization has become more aggressive internally in some ways about expectations in terms of, you know, what party fealty looks like, what it looks like to be a good Republican member in the legislature. Right. And there have been fights about whether the party should engage in these or not. It's not like this is clear because obviously, and this is where I think a real clear understanding of parties is useful, which is like, you know, the elected officials who are Republicans aren't necessarily asking the party organization to police their efforts.
Right.
And so this is a very ripe area for politics.
Yeah. And there's, you know, Renzo Downey has a good kind of table setter in the Tribune today for people that are interested in this that is, you know, worth looking at and, you know, kind of a good long read about some of these issues. You know, telescoping out, I was saying before we got started, I mean, I think one of the interesting things that is lurking here that I probably didn't think about much as I was thinking, oh, yeah, conventions are going to happen. Honestly, kind of so what?
You know, yeah. It's Jim.
No offense to any intended to anybody. But is that it is part of this thing. It's come up in the pod a couple times and we've written about it a little bit. The degree to which there may be structural changes going on in the party system, at least in the state and in different parts of the country, in terms of parties being able to do something in the United States, which we typically don't associate with parties in the United States. They're more associated with European parties.
Yeah.
You know, which is, you know, having the capacity, the ability, the influence to enforce party discipline, to be a vehicle for party discipline.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that is the play that is being made by the Republican Party of Texas right now. There's just no two ways about that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've probably not been as awake at the switch on that as I could be. Not to flagellate myself or anything, but
no, go ahead. It's okay.
So, you know,
I don't mind.
Yeah, I'll get the cat o' nine tails. But you know, the thing we kind of wanted to hit on today, because it really did, is, you know, I have kind of a, you know, my jokey note in my notes is, you know, suddenly data centers,
right?
Even though it's not so sudden,
right?
And the state's electrical infrastructure obviously has been a very visible and persistent part of the policy agenda from the moment Winter Storm Uri kind of knocked everything out.
And to a less extent, but still also true, water too.
Just, yeah.
You know, in terms
of and water is attendant to this.
Yeah.
Has become a part of this. And water was, you know, in some ways kind of an underappreciated part of the Uri fallout too.
Yeah, it's underneath the electricity that has been an ongoing water
discussion.
I mean,
if anything, water was almost more on the agenda.
Yeah.
Before that, because there had been the big water legislation in the teens, and, you know, a dedicated constituency on water that succeeded reasonably, not in some huge way, in pushing water a little bit onto the agenda in a in an intermittently visible way, put it that way, right? But you know, I joke suddenly, and part of this is just the cognitive part of this. You know,
no, I hear you.
Once you're paying attention to it, since I started thinking about doing this for today's podcast, you know, yesterday, I guess, day before, maybe. Seems like every other email in my inbox touches on this in some way.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Right down to, you know, a few minutes before, you know, came to the office, got a Axios Energy mailer, one of the billion Axios emails I get. That was all about, you know, Amazon pushing back on their water use at their data centers, and to your point about water being connected, but also the fact that it's just, you know, I mean, I guess what we want to get at today a little bit, or one of the sub themes, is the suddenly joke is a very inside joke, because, you know, this was certainly part of the legislative discussion in the last session. Since the beginning of the AI boom, but even before that, this notion of these big data centers, how they fit in economically, environmentally, resource-wise, how they fit into just the general kind of utility mix, if you will, has been going on for a while. I mean, the first wave of it was for the development of cloud computing before AI, and then the AI development has just juiced that like crazy.
It's kind of hard for me to think of a policy area in my lifetime where government has been so obviously chasing. I mean, they're so I mean, and you're talking about data centers, but even kind of, you know, I think, like, well, you know, this is not the first time about data centers, and, you know, and we're gonna be careful here about not, you know, aligning too much between AI and data centers where it's not useful. But I mean, to the extent that, you know, I can just think, you know, last session there was like, oh, you know, deep fakes, you know, oh boy, you know, and it's sort of even just getting their hands around kind of the landscape.
Yeah.
And it's changed so much dramatically even, you know, since then. So, I mean, I think that's sort of, you know, the interesting, and it's just an interesting aspect of this overall. And the other piece, just as we're starting this conversation off, and I think you're kind of pointed to this about the suddenly joke, is that, you know, I think it's hard not to think about the subject with any seriousness and not quickly see, like, how many dimensions and layers and how much connective tissue is.
Yeah, it's a sprawling
issue. It's so remarkably sprawling. And it's not just – and in a policy way, and we'll talk about some of this stuff, right? You know, in a policy way, because, you know, we're talking about energy, and that's a huge policy area, right? You know, but also we're talking about kind of the philosophies of the parties and what freedom looks like in Texas and all this kind of stuff, and then just basic political economy questions, and really the state's orientation towards business, and all this stuff is like just kind of swirling around. And
we'll
kind
of unspool some of that.
But it's just to say, there's no way to neatly package this.
Yeah. I mean, and what I was going to say is, one of the things that's interesting, like, from the kind of things we talk about, is that goes back to the suddenly piece, is that, and we'll kind of start here based on at least what we have, is the degree to which, you know, this is a elite policymaking issue-specific conversation that has been going on for a while amongst the governing and business class, if you will, or sectors. But just how much, you know, I think what we're seeing here is, and the trigger for this being Governor Abbott's letter to the PUC and ERCOT yesterday, which I'll talk about in a minute. You know, it's almost like that's the iceberg popping out of the ocean.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, all of a sudden it's like, oh, there it is.
Eruption.
Yeah. Kind of knew there was one out here somewhere.
Yeah.
And people had been talking about it. But, you know, the fact that I think that not to give away the ending here in some ways, but the fact that Governor Abbott has made a pretty bold move on this, a bold public gesture, certainly when it comes to the governance, political, business nexus, is telling us something.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't have a lot of focused public opinion data on this, and we'll come to that theme in a minute. Just to kind of get to this point about the letter. So yesterday, Governor Greg Abbott sent a letter to PUC Chairman Thomas Gleason, ERCOT CEO Pablo Vegas. This is where they were the addressees anyway, calling on their, you know, of course, linked entities to exercise some oversight of data center development in Texas. And we'll put a link to the letter in the post to this podcast on our website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And there was sort of two sets of bullet-pointed directives, but also some interesting things in the connective tissue in this two-page letter. So they directed the PUC to take action to ensure that data centers' interconnections will result in reduced residential electric bills. Now, we could focus on that and talk about that the whole podcast.
Yeah.
From both a political and a policy perspective. We'll just put a pin in that. The second point was directing the PUC to take action to require data centers to pay for all of their electric infrastructure costs so that ensured that no residential ratepayer is burdened by those costs. Now, you'll notice in those two things, we went from reduced to the lower threshold of
burden. Right.
You know, just not to parse this too closely. And then just directed the PUC and ERCOT to review their existing authority, and that's interesting too, I think, and to identify necessary actions that can be taken under those authorities to safeguard Texans, their property, and resources. And there's no modifier on resources in that, which is pretty broad.
Yeah.
And then there was like another half dozen items in kind of the back half of the letter that was directed at the legislature, that Abbott, you know, quote unquote, pledged to work with the legislature on next year, some of which build on the steps that were taken in SB6, the kind of data center build out bill from the last session. But it also added some new priorities that I think, you know, definitely have political implications amidst what we're seeing as these localized pushbacks on data center construction and how they're operated in various parts of the state. And that's happening nationwide. And, you know, a few of those jumped out at me, although they all have their things. I don't want to read the entire letter, but, you know, top of the list, Abbott wants the legislature to codify the PUC's actions to require data centers to pay for their own electric infrastructure costs and resulting in lower residential ratepayer costs. So if you step back from a kind of political system perspective, that's interesting.
Yeah.
He's directing the PUC to follow these directives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the governor doesn't have the formal authority over the PUC that might imply.
Right.
But he appoints the members of the PUC.
Yeah.
And connecting, and one of the themes we'll hit on here, we know that Governor Abbott has played has overseen his appointees with a pretty strong hand.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Especially since the winter storm. I mean,
right.
To be clear, right?
But, you know, but I mean, even in the like more general sense.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, right.
Right. So, and then there's a couple other things that are interesting, but I'll skip over a couple, but then also, to the point we were talking about right before we started, repeal sales tax exemptions and other outdated or unnecessary incentives for data centers.
Right.
Also interesting in ways that we can... and then finally, of the things that stuck out to me, require data centers to reduce impacts on local communities by implementing best practices such as setbacks, noise reduction technology, and other measures that take into account the concern of neighbors. Now, sounds to me, and I suspect it would sound to a lot of people that would be listening to this, like that's sort of what we traditionally, the kinds of things we traditionally expect local authorities to do.
Well, if they have the authority to do that, correct.
Traditionally.
Right?
Well, you know, setbacks, noise reduction. I mean, noise ordinances and
what?
Property setbacks and all of that are generally local, historically been local things.
I think one of the, I will say this, I think that's correct. But one, I totally agree with that. I think the one complexity here is that because of where a lot of these projects are coming, are being proposed,
yeah,
and they're in usually in unincorporated areas within counties,
right,
but not within a city limit, it
a little less subject to home rule.
Well, and there's a lot, and I think there's a lot, I don't think there's zoning. So, I mean, just right, generally speaking, a lot of these things would fall kind of under zoning kind of restrictions that cities, yeah, would generally have some control over, although less now than they used to, but counties generally don't. And that's been a lot of the sort of the pushback in some ways, is that a lot of the counties, as I understand it, haven't had the tools at their disposal to even kind of like place these kinds of requirements on what,
right,
is otherwise just private property in an unincorporated area, right?
Right. And so, the governor wants the PUC to,
right,
take some steps, then wants the legislature to act on this. And, you know, I mean, it from a tactical policymaking perspective and a governance perspective, you know, kind of classic Greg Abbott, ultimately,
yeah,
you know, trying to set the sort of stage using the executive branch means at his disposal to kind of lead the legislature to the extent possible in that direction and engage in some agenda setting early on. Now, you know, we're going to sort this, I think, into sort of short-term, medium-term,
yeah,
long-term implications of all this.
No, I mean, but I think
that's there with that.
You said something important too, which is, I mean, you noted when there's not a modifier on resources. And I think it's important to remember,
yeah,
here, this is where, remember, this is Greg Abbott, right? And to the extent that, you know, there are modifiers or there aren't modifiers, this is one of the few people who I think you should take that as a decided choice,
yeah,
to include or not include those kinds of modifiers, because that sort of legalistic approach to these things is very much Greg Abbott's approach to these,
right,
kinds of things. So I mean, think, you know, if something's not there, you assume it's not there for a reason. And I think, you know, and you kind of look at this, and I'm kind of looking at this thing, it's like, how does this make its way into an emergency item?
Yeah.
You know, it's,
yeah,
kind of how I'm like thinking about this. How does,
well,
this...
and there's, you know, scuttlebutt out there in the ether that I, you know, don't want to report too much hearsay, but the rollout of this letter seems to have been a little bit complicated.
Yeah, it seems like,
you know, in that, you know, it was reported very early on yesterday.
Yeah,
in one of the political newsletters in the bullpen newsletter, that the letter was coming.
Mm-hmm.
But there's kind of, you know, it's unclear how ready this was. You know, it might have, you know, that might be nothing, but there does seem to have been kind of an advance notice of the letter. Whether that was deliberate or not, I don't know.
So do you
put
think
it that way.
So just to tie the start of this conversation together, I mean, how much do you think, I mean, the things that I'm seeing in my mind, just trying to think about the pressures available, besides the fact that this issue has been, quote unquote, as you said, everywhere all of a sudden.
Yeah.
But also, like, what's swirling in my mind is sort of the two other things, which is one we already mentioned. We've got the party convention coming up, in which,
yeah,
this is going to be a topic of discussion.
Yes.
I know reporters are watching it specifically. And the other thing I'm thinking about is last week, at the executive level, sort of the AI rules that were and then weren't and then were, and sort of,
yeah,
how much, you know, it almost, to get some, I mean, we've been talking a lot about how do you control the state level discussion in 2026 and not get it totally.
Right. Now, by the executive level, you mean the Trump thing.
Yeah, the,
right,
Trump, yeah.
At the national level.
At the
level.
National level,
right,
right,
right.
And so in some ways, I mean, I'm in my mind, I don't know how much you're seeing, like, I'm sort of seeing this as like, you know, is Abbott trying to maintain, trying to gain some kind of control over this issue that's really kind,
yeah,
of out of control at the moment, you know,
yeah,
at least in Texas.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the answer to that to me is, you know, whether the letter was supposed to come out yesterday or the next or not or whatever,
yeah,
it was obviously coming.
Right.
Right. So now all of that, I think, does lead us into like, let's pause and go, you know, we'll go back to our,
yeah,
regularly scheduled,
yeah,
program,
okay,
in the sense of before we start talking about you know, the broader kind of political economy. What I'm thinking in my mind is, you know, the political economy of data centers in Texas. You know, let's talk a little bit about the emergence of the issue, the degree to which data centers are salient to the public right now. And again, if you're somebody that's following this issue, you would be forgiven for going, what in the F are you talking about?
Right.
Of course, you know, people are pushing back on this at the local level. But look, there's also an area in which something that can be important locally can be generating a little bit of press coverage, can even be connecting with some national issues. But it's a very crowded issue environment out there always, and especially now.
Right.
And so I think it's fair to say, you know, what do we know about this in public opinion? Now, to give just a little sense of the scope of that, and again, in this morning's, you know, in you know, going on this, everything I opened in my inbox seemed to be about this morning. An analysis in Doug Lewin's Texas Energy and Power newsletter came in my inbox this morning from his Substack, and people that follow energy know who Doug Lewin is, and he's got a, you know, particular position in all of this, but not a guy who's uninformed. And the newsletter had a letter from a private sector exec in the space I'd never heard of, named, I have no idea if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Seiya Fabode or Fabode. Now, according to this, you know, the data center opposition nationally, I believe was the implication of this, has grown from just three actions in 2024 to 81 in the first 5 months of 2026, with 31 moratoriums and a 76% denial rate when these projects reach a public vote. Now, again, what that means is not exactly clear.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And the person says the main reasons for these denials has been power grid strain in 30% of the cases and water consumption worries in 25% of the cases, so that over $70 billion in proposed data center investment in 40 states is now denied, blocked, or under legal challenge. Now, I'm not vouching for those numbers. The author of this is seems to be an entrepreneur in the kind of using AI to look at both water use and data center issues, et cetera. And,
right.
You know, he's got a dog in the fight. So, but I don't have any reason to think that those numbers are completely manufactured, and they seem sensible.
I think the general point of them is the
right,
is the point.
Right. And then he, you know, sort of ends, you know, sort of follows that paragraph by saying that 16 of these moratorium denials have been in Texas.
Right.
So that's kind of where, in terms of thinking about, you know, the people that might say, what are you talking about? This is clearly already a public issue. Mm-hmm. Point taken. There's one thing for something to be a public issue. There's another thing for it to be enough of a public issue that we begin to see real patterns in public opinion formation.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So what have we done? We've not done much about this in our direct UT polling, but we did put the subject of data centers in the issue battery we talk about in here a lot, where we ask people how much they've heard in the news about certain issues.
Right.
So what did we find of that in April?
Yeah. So, you know, what we found in April was that data centers in Texas, in terms of, you know, how much have you heard in the news about each of the following? About a little less than a quarter of Texas voters, 24%, said that they had heard a lot about data centers in Texas. The question, of course, is like, where does this rank, to give you a sense? And the answer is relatively low. It's slightly above accusations against Cesar Chavez, 22%, or slightly above that, slightly below the U.S. Senate race, which, by the way, we've been pointing out again, something that you all are paying a lot of attention to, maybe like data centers, but a lot of other people still focusing on other things. You know, the war with Iran, 76% of people are paying a lot of attention to that. The moon mission, the Artemis moon mission, was 52% of Texans that had heard a lot about that. Funding for the Department of Homeland Security was 41%. And so this is, I would say, we call this not the lowest in terms of like attention and salience, but it's
in the lower tier.
It's in the lower tier. Now, I think one of the things, again, to your point and about sort of this audience I'm making about this audience, this podcast, and sort of people who listen, say, what are you talking about, bozos? Where we do see a lot of differences when it comes to data
really
centers.
Really the only big subgroup difference.
The only big subgroup difference. I mean, so when I say how much have you heard about data centers in Texas, 27% of Democrats have heard a lot, 24% of Republicans, right? Not a huge difference there. when we look, you know, urban, suburban, rural, it's 31% in urban environments, 20% in suburban, 24% in rural, not a lot there.
And let's pause on that for 1 second. Yeah. Just on the urban, rural, I mean, I thought that was interesting that there was not a whole lot of variance there, given that the spin of this issue in a lot of the coverage in Texas has been, well, you know, and they're building these data centers in red areas.
Right.
And it's really, you know, rattling the cages of, and we don't, that's not showing up yet.
You know, and I got to say, people say that, and I think that has been the story. And I've sort of taken that as an article of faith to some degree. But when you go and you look, you know, the Texas Tribune recently put together an interactive map where you can look at all the proposed projects in the state and based on their size, nice little bubble plot on the map. And if you actually go and look at that map and you look and you know something about Texas geography and everything, you know, I would actually say my takeaway from that was, wow, these are actually in a lot more competitive places in the state, not necessarily clearly rural per se.
Well, it's a, you know, look, it's a wonky distinction that we make a lot that not everybody does or people don't. You know, look, a lot of these are in what we would call exurban areas, right? So they're not, you know, they're not building them in the middle of Houston.
No.
But they're not necessarily building them, you know, in the middle of nowhere either.
You know what I think of a lot
kind of in these edge areas.
Well, what I think of a lot is, like, I had a conversation with a reporter recently about Collin County, right? And that's a great example of the trajectory that we're talking about here. Yeah. You know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, Collin County was rural, right? I mean, you know, this is the political base of Ken Paxton, a very conservative place. And ultimately, it still is a pretty conservative place, but it's grown dramatically. The population there, it's one of the fastest growing counties in the country. Like most of these formerly rural, now ex-urban, almost suburban counties is because of growth. They've changed pretty dramatically. And so I think there's a lot of projects in these areas because this is where there is a lot of growth going on in general.
Right.
Right. And ultimately, you don't, you know, as much as you want cheap land and whatever, you still want your data center to be, like, you know, connected to all kinds of things.
Right.
Technology, you know, I mean, both electricity, infrastructure.
To the point, infrastructure.
Right. You can't just be in the middle of nowhere, right? That's pretty expensive. And so, but these areas, I'd say, yeah, they lean Republican.
You want to be somewhere between somewhere and nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what freedom smells like. They lean Republican still, but these are also the parts of the state that, you know, if you're saying where can Democrats looking to make inroads, well, these are the parts of the state the Democrats are looking to make inroads. These are the competitive counties that we look at that are outside of Dallas, outside of Harris, outside of Travis.
But not too far.
But not too far. No, like but adjacent.
Right.
But still adjacent. But anyway,
I mean, the other thing I would add about that is that before you go is also that you know, when you're talking about these things, you don't build them overnight.
Right.
And so what, and this is an empirical question I don't have the answer to, and this is why I should have caveated that, look, neither of us are policy experts in this area. Mm-hmm. So the policy experts out there, you want to email us more information, more
I'd love
connection. Texas Politics at, not project.
No, right? it's Texas Politics at UTexas.
Texas Politics at UTexas.edu, or, you know, you can dig up our individual email addresses, whatever. But also that, you know, those areas are growing so rapidly that if in 2023, just to pick a halfway recent year, you kind of went, hey, here's a good spot for this thing. Seems like we got a little room to grow. We're not too far from stuff, but we're not necessarily on top of people. Well, by the time you get around to going and either building the thing or beginning to build the thing or entering the permitting process or whatever, you know, it might have changed.
Well, and interestingly, those sorts of areas you're talking about, actually, there have been ongoing discussions here about this very problem because a lot of these fast-growing areas, their big problem is water.
Right.
And the big problem is the expense it takes to create the water treatment and the facilities that are required for these fast-growing areas when the tax base doesn't yet exist.
Right.
It's just a real policy challenge. And this is sort of, I mean, it's in the same space, you know, just generally speaking. Now, there is one big difference, though, and this is the thing
so
that
go
kind
back
of,
to the, yeah, the
let's
demos.
Go back to, this is important because this is something, again, for you all, and I think for people who are sort of paying attention to this at, you know, we'd call like an elite level, there tends to be a pretty big disjuncture when we look at attitudes towards data centers, but really AI generally, the sort of tech space, and it's education. So what we see is that whereas no more than about 1 in 5 voters who have, you know, less than a college degree, some college or less, say they've heard a lot about data centers. When we go to college grads, 4-year college degrees, it's 29% have heard a lot. When we go to postgrads, it's 37%. And this kind of pattern here between college degree holders and non-college degree holders when it comes to their attention, use, and attitudes towards AI and these kinds of technologies. That's where you see the big gaps.
Right.
And I think that's important. So that's why when it's sort of like, yeah, isn't everybody talking about this? Like, well, if you listen to this podcast, there's a good chance that you're part of conversations.
You're
hearing about it, right?
Yeah.
But this is why to say this is not necessarily the case for a lot of people. And this is kind of important here. Should I keep talking about the public attitudes a little bit?
Yeah,
AI? Yeah, okay. So, I mean, one of the keys here is sort of, you know, the flip side of this is that data centers are the infrastructure that fuels AI, right? And the challenge, I think, in terms of one of the many challenges here on the policy side is that it's not as though people, mass public, has clearly and fully developed attitudes towards AI yet, which I think first we should say is, you know, people who study public attitudes should make a lot of sense to us, right? Because what is AI? Well, it depends, right? It's a general tool that's being deployed in all kinds of different ways. So then if you say to somebody, what's your attitude towards AI? In some sense, it actually is kind of meaningless. Also, it's the case that AI is being deployed in a lot of ways that people aren't aware of, right? So there's that kind of piece of it, which is to say that when you go and then add to this idea that, well, we need the infrastructure for AI, it's important for, I think, people to understand that it's not as though most voters out there are sitting there looking at a scale and saying, well, this is clearly worth it. Because AI is so important to me and I love AI so much and it's fueling all this economic change and this positive growth. And so actually we need these data centers. And in fact, there's an argument to be made that maybe people are concerned about AI. In fact, it's the opposite, which is to say that there's concern about the economic threat that AI poses to people's jobs, whatever. Yeah. Now, I will say again, just to point this out again, that is not something that is in front of people's faces, right? For the most part, when we look at economic concerns in the April poll, only 43% of Texans say that they're very concerned about the impact of artificial intelligence on the economy, which is not none. I mean, that's not low. Right. I mean, that's still up there, but it's kind of in the middle of the pack again. It definitely pales in comparison to the things that are right in front of people's faces. The price of food and consumer goods, 65%, the cost of healthcare, 63%, the price of gasoline and energy, 61%. Even the cost of housing is 53%, that's 10 points higher. And so when you're thinking about like the extent of like how salient this is, how on people's minds, the, you know, AI's impact on the economy, whether or not that filters into their views about whether data centers are good or bad, right? And all that, that's not really something that for most people is front of mind because they're more worried about the price of gas, price of groceries, right? And so I think that's one thing that sort of makes understanding the policy conversation here a little bit, you know, it's challenging, right? Because there's an elite discussion going on here around this really complicated policy area. And I think, you know, you've touched on it, but we'll kind of get into this a little bit more, which is because of the connection between data centers and real hard infrastructure, water and energy, and how complicated those policy areas are, and how many other vested interests exist in those areas with sometimes, you know, corresponding and sometimes conflicting incentives and impulses, this becomes like a real, I don't want to say a policy quagmire, but it's like, it's hard to...
You know, it's got multiple, it's multidimensional.
Right, it's multidimensional in a real, real fundamental way. I don't know if there's much else. I mean, I'll say, you know, the Lyceum did some good polling on this, a couple different things. You know, this year, the Lyceum, which is Texas Adults, was looking at the position that different industries hold in Texans' mind in terms of their importance to the Texas economy.
Yeah, that's what that question was. How important is
each of these industries to the Texas economy? Yeah. And in general, I mean, this is just an important, technology is kind of a middle of the pack player in Texas. Oil and gas, healthcare, farming and agriculture, and education are still way out in front when we talk about what people think of when they think of Texas.
And just a quick pin in the farming and agriculture, you know, if you're wondering about the screwworm discussion and the prominence of that both nationally and in the state. This is a, you know, big part of the economy and a big part of public consciousness of the economy.
Right. So that's just to say that, you know, again, technology is, this isn't, you know, we're not California, you know, even like, you know, Massachusetts, probably like this is still not something that hits sort of people's in North Carolina. I'm just thinking of different places. People might think of technology as higher in the economy. In 2025 in the Lyceum, we actually asked it about trust in large technology companies. Not great. Only 10% of Texans said they had a great deal of trust in large technology companies. 41% said some, 25% said very little. This was about on par with
That's interesting.
It's on par with about the news media So that tells you something.
Shows you how bad off they are.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's why I said that, right? And then in general, you know, we asked about, you know, feelings towards AI. There was a lot of neutral non-opinions, and this was just a year ago, so that's a good point. Much higher share of non-opinions amongst non-college educated people right. with lower income. So there's a socioeconomic aspect to this that's just makes, I think, people who are very attuned to conversations about politics and political economy very attuned to this discussion.
But with, you know, if you were to get a you know, I mean, it makes me think, and obviously somebody's done this, but you know, if you had a focus group mm-hmm. and you kind of said, hey, so what do you, when I say data centers, what comes to mind?
Well, I asked our audio engineers or young men, right? Beforehand, what they had heard about data centers, you know, they're like, kind of bad for the environment, you know? And it's like, yeah, you know. And I think there's some, they're like looking at me like, nah.
We're not naming names.
Not naming names. There's some more, but I think that's what you would about expect, right? It's not going to be an extended treatise on, you know.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I think if you're going to build data centers and you have to have more powerful processors, but it is going to have downstream benefits. I mean, you know, nobody's going to say that.
In a mass opinion, sense.
In a general,
right? Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So I think that's the first thing I just think that everyone should take away from this is just to remember that, like, you know, this is an ongoing and developing discussion. It's complicated. You know, most people don't really understand AI technology. They don't understand why it's so data intensive or you know, energy intensive or water intensive. Again, no normal person is going to understand the underlying infrastructure needs for this technology. But also, as of right now, not to crap on any industry, but like, the actual promise of the industry hasn't been realized in ways that they can point to and say, look at this disease we've just eradicated. Look at, you know, wins.
Yeah, in a way that have a broad
public, you know, good kind
of
thing.
The guys who publish Axios are preoccupied with it.
They're so preoccupied with it. But
you know.
But it's kind of hard when you say, like, you know, I mean, you know, but they're doing these interviews with these, you know, AI CEOs who are saying, yeah, no, we're gonna take all the profits and we're gonna start giving them back to people. Well, maybe not the profits per se, because we haven't generated, but we're going to do compute power. And it's like, just like, my wife like almost spit take with the water. It's like, what is, like, you know, the person who's working at CVS going to do with some compute power that they're paying for with their tax dollars?
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, it's this weird conversation.
Other than wonder if they're not going to have a job at CVS next year.
Yeah. Or know that they can't do any junior copywriting jobs or whatever they might want to do. So, I mean, it's kind of like, and I think this is part of this. I mean, one of the things we talked about this before, and it's interesting kind of circling back to Abbott here, which is, you know, I thought one of the good pieces in the Tribune a while back that we talked about in the podcast, I don't remember who wrote it exactly. I think it was Gabby. I think it was a long piece on the sort of the data center, the crosswinds in the Republican Party over this.
Yeah.
And there was a piece in that talked about, you know, some representatives of Abbott's office basically talking to some of the data center representatives, basically telling them, you guys got to get your act together here because you're losing this badly. And I think this is kind of the environment that we're in right now, which is that, you know, I don't think the public sees a lot of benefit to this. The costs are right in front of them, right? Which is it's going to raise your energy bill. It's going to, which Abbott's addressing. It's going to take all your water, which Abbott's trying to address. It's going to ruin the physical geography of the place that you're in. And the question becomes, for what? And the funny thing to me, this is, again,
they're going to make me pay for it.
Well, and this is the interesting thing to me. And I love, and like the argument that I think is kind of being made at the local level, which I'm totally, you know, I would think sympathetic to, is, yeah, but we need the money. The local entities are like, I mean, there's this, if you follow the story, the data center they're considering at in the county just outside of Waco, right? And man, you know, they're kind of like, hey, and they show you there's all these pictures and these articles of the roads in this town, right? And it's just a nightmare. I mean, the roads are like, they look horrific in a sort of way, like you would never want to drive your car there. And they're like, hey, if we could just get this data center, if Waco would just agree to give us the water and like we could just hook up, we could like solve all our problems.
Right.
But also, you know, I'm thinking on the flip side, looking at the sort of broader environment, it's, you know, it's 2026, and Ken Paxton's office just sent a letter to like 120 communities telling them they can't raise their tax rates because they haven't done an audit yet. So there's these, like, you know.
Well, that kind of brings us back to the point that there's a lot of things that I think the governing class, the apparatus of government, the governor, mm-hmm. are trying to get their heads around.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it kind of brings us back to the, you know, the instigator at least for the podcast. And you know, and I think it's a major, you know, this is a major gesture by the governor,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, this is a pretty, you know, it's just a letter, whatever one can, you know, again. But I think a lot of people are paying attention to this.
Yeah.
You know, text ledge, social media, phone, you know, had phone calls yesterday, et cetera, et cetera. Let's talk about that then a little bit, knowing that. So, I mean, I think we can sum up. I mean, you sort of summed up the public opinion discussion. It seems to me what we're seeing here is an emerging issue that's got a negative lean right now.
Yeah.
If you're somebody who wants to build a data center, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, there's not deep well-formed. I mean, I think what you look at this, if you're the strategic communications person talking to the executives wanting to build these data centers, one of the things you're probably thinking is, we're in a little bit of, the wind is not at our back on this. And the goal has got to be to try to turn this around, right?
Yeah.
if we're not going to get resistance at every.
The only advantage, I think, or I don't know what I'm saying is an advantage.
But it's still early. I mean.
Yeah. That's the caveat.
It's not as early as they'd like, probably. I mean, the way that you're talking about the sun, the salience of this being kind of in our last new thing.
Yeah.
Kind of lower tier.
Yeah.
But, pretty far off zero.
Well, the horse isn't out of the barn, but its head is peeking out. And it's and I think that's sort of the issue. I mean, I think the one, if I'm going to say, if we were consulting with a client.
Good
who is,
rural metaphor.
If we were consulting, thank you. If I stay here long enough. If we were consulting with a client who are like, what do you do here? What's the strategic environment look like? What are the advantages and disadvantages? Obviously, we've kind of laid out all the disadvantages. But an advantage line in that is the fact that it's not as salient as other things. People haven't necessarily formed strong attitudes about it. It is a complicated issue, and because of its complication, there's a large number of people who are never really going to fully understand what's going on here, which means you have a lot of flexibility.
Look, like most public policy issues, to be fair.
Yeah, you have a lot of flexibility about how to approach it and how to drive the issue forward. But I think one of the things about sort of that little reporting of the Abbott's people and then now this is absent any sort of collective action on this sort of disparate set of actors – you're kind of leaving a vacuum. And at this point, I think Abbott's saying, okay, well, let's start a conversation. I mean, just now we're kind of moving to, I mean, there's sort of two pieces of this I see. We can talk about either one. One is sort of the in front of us election. And then the second step to this is sort of, what does this portend for kind of the legislative session?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I had sorted it out. Yeah. There's kind of a short-term, medium-term, medium to long-term.
Right.
I mean, look, in the short-term, thinking more about politics than policy when I first saw this,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of like, Greg Abbott is going to take the lead on this issue or, assert leader, put it this way, assert leadership on an issue
mm-hmm.
that's bubbling up in a lot of, even with the caveats we set, we mentioned a few minutes ago, it is bubbling up in a lot of relatively Republican regions of the state.
Right.
Right. And it involves not only kind of regular people and its impact on these local communities at a kind of lower levels, the wrong way to put it, at a more local level, though. I mean, it's a little bit more localized, but it's beginning to kind of aggregate as more than a series of local issues.
Right.
Which makes sense because it is a big structural thing. So from a kind of the politics of governance perspective, this is very on brand for Governor Abbott.
Yeah.
This is happening. They're getting the sense of this happening and they are going to try to get in front of it and lead on it and shape it as they see fit.
Yeah.
Right. Now, the most immediate thing, honestly, the first thing I thought of was – this is an economic campaign issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
You go back to some of those excerpts that we read from that letter, that whatever your view, however much there were deep policy implications in this, and there were, this is also something that if somebody asked Greg Abbott or a surrogate, it's great that the border's secure now. It's great that you are going to prevent Sharia law, all of the preferred.
Right.
Republican agenda issues right now, but I'm bleeding out economically. What are you doing for me there? He said, "Oh, did you hear? We're going to lower your utility prices.
Well, this is
we're going to lower. Your electric bills are going. We're working right now. I have ordered the Public Utility Commission to, you know, that's why the language of that is to lower your electric utility. So it's, you know, I mean, you can over elaborate this, I think. But, you know, it's pretty obvious an emphasis on lowering prices for consumers is something that Republicans could use right now. And the governor is on the ballot, and the governor is going to be asked about these things.
Well, and I'll say, and what ties us to the last point is it's only possible to make a claim that seems so ludicrous on its face, is assuming that people don't actually understand what's going on here, right? Because the idea that these I mean, look, I'm not saying it's not possible. Look, it's possible. But I know that based on the last discussion about getting industrial users to generate their own power, it's pretty complicated. Right. And so,
yeah, although it's probably not as complicated as you think.
Probably
there's a
not.
Lot from a Paul. I mean, I know a little bit about this.
Yeah, no, I know you do.
There is a lot of, you know, what they call co-location.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. I mean, but I just say the idea that like these you know, the concern is that these are massive, massive industrial resource users. And it's like, no. I've said it, and actually, they're going to lower your rates because.
Well, I mean, but the massiveness is part of the point there. That's more of a medium term.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, somebody a little more in this space I was talking to made the observation that, and I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
And there's precedent for this and some of the other, the implementation of SB 6 and some of the other things, or the provisions and implementation of SB 6, is that when you tell somebody who's going to apply for, to build a data center, one of the things you have to illustrate to us is that you are going to meet all of these requirements for energy generation, you know, impact, you know, lack of impact or, you know, some kind of impact on consumer rates. And let's set that aside for a second. That's a barrier to entry.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the things that they have been concerned about in these, you know, and a lot of them, and part of it does come to something we were talking about, you were kind of referencing before the podcast, from earlier economic development programs where, you know, you have a lot of applications for projects that are speculative.
Right.
And then what happens is later on people go, okay, let's do the program assessment. How many of these projects actually broke ground? How many of them were actually implemented? And a bunch of them aren't because they're just fishing. They're kind of fishing, speculative fishing expeditions.
It's very historically Texas, actually.
Right. And you know, look, it's part of, you know, part of the cost of doing the, if mixed terms here, part of the cost of doing the business of economic regulation, right?
Yeah.
Is that, you know, you have to think about the consequences of all this. So, you know, but I will say, you know, I was, again, talking to somebody in this space recently, kind of going, you know, it's good for them to say, you will do this and it will result in lower residential rates. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm not clear. And again, I'm not a policy guy.
Right.
For those of you out there that can explain this to me, I'd love to get an email or a phone call. But what does that mechanism actually look like?
Right.
Right? I'm just not sure.
Yeah. No,
but nonetheless, that's why I call this a short-term consideration, right? Because this would not be the first time that somebody campaigning has said, yeah, we're going to order X to do Y, and that's going to result in lower costs for you, and then that not happening.
Well, and especially in an area like this, right?
Right.
I mean, moving along to that, because I think that's exactly, I mean, to your point, I think the hard part for me is sort of thinking, well, not the hard part. I think the thing that I get stuck on is this can both be really good politics and totally sincere policymaking.
Right.
It can also be really good politics and partially sincere policymaking, or, you know, and really what does policymaking look like? At the end of the day, Abbott's one player in this. He's laying out some markers. He's going to have some tools at his disposal at different points in the legislative session to put more or less pressure on this. But I think what strikes me about this, you know, and I don't know if this is where you want to go with it, but like, you know, in very few areas does Abbott, I mean, like, I hate to say this, but like, seem so small. Like, this was an important thing for him to do, I think, for the party to try to, like, in some ways, set some ground rules at least, so it's not just going everywhere. Or if, you know, if you're a local official and you want to go in a direction, at least you know where you stand with the governor. And part of that is, say, it's not obvious, right? I mean, but like 2 weeks ago, the state was promoting the fact that we're leading with Fortune 500 companies all of a sudden. Like, we, you know, that's a big thing for the governor and for the state's lead, you know, governing parties being open for business. You know, if you're in Austin, there's so many self-driving cars everywhere, like, because we are down for it, right? You know, that's the general brand of Texas. And so on the one hand, you know, Abbott's got to maintain that. I think that's an incentive. On the other hand, he is trying to set some ground rules because he's kind of being forced to play the cop within the party a little bit. But then going forward to, you know, to your point, or to not to your point, this is my point now. It's like, just like back of the envelope, and you're saying like, oh, $700 billion in data centers on hold right now, right?
Yeah.
And I'm saying like a little math, right? If a data center is like $1 billion or a couple data centers take $1 billion to build them, you could give every member of the House a $100,000 check. You could cut every member in the Texas Senate $250,000. Yeah,
you were making this point earlier. I'm not sure I really understand it, honestly.
Well, my point is that the cost – well, first of all, my point is that the cost of these actors engage – I mean, I guess what means speculation is an interesting question when you're talking about the size and the sum total of the economic transactions we're talking about here. If it costs $1 billion, let's say, to build a data center – it costs $25 million to give every legislator $100,000 to $250,000 just to get a conversation, of course, which I'm not saying anybody's buying votes here. But all of this is going to be very open to discussion, right? And the actual amount to like be a major, major campaign donor in Texas is like a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of the overall cost of one of these projects, which is not a normal situation. I mean, just to say, I mean, there are a couple industries where that might be true, but there are not a lot of industries where you'd say like, hey, this is basically like the equivalent of like more paperwork in zoning cases in Austin when it comes to building something. That's like that's like the relative equivalence of this. And so again, I'm not trying to be flip about it. It's like, oh, they're just going to go writing these, you know, massive checks. But I mean, we did just see a Railroad Commission runoff in which a major industrial player got really concerned about what was going to happen and wrote multiple $100,000 checks to a candidate who ultimately lost, which is fine. But I see sort of looking at Abbott saying, yeah, this is what I think should happen. It's like, yeah, but then the legislature is going to meet in 2027. And even if you cleared out the speculators, right, you're still going to have some major players in here who might say, well, you know, you really want us to be in charge to pay for all the infrastructure? I mean, we're the only, you know.
Yeah,
I just wonder how much power Abbott's really going to have when push comes to shove with some of this. Now, of course, he can always veto stuff. He can always use the regular powers at his disposal. Yeah. And he's also going to be having these conversations. So that's why when I say this, like, I understand the politics of this make amazing sense. I think they're fabulous politics for the GOP right now and trying to find a message where they can show what they're affirmatively doing about cost of living, addressing an issue that's kind of a problem for the party. The sincerity of it, moving forward into the policy, is this really a description of what's going to happen? You raised this already. Asking them to pay for their infrastructure costs is a big, big, big ask, right?
Well, I mean, and I guess, you know, I guess I think about it differently because, A, I don't, you know, I don't know. I think this equivalence of what they're spending on contributions or whatever, I don't know. But I will say that my sense is that if you're the major players in this space and that's the cost of doing business and you know that, I mean, it's maybe a different way of putting this that sets aside like where you should spend your money, but if you can create barriers to entry to some of your competitors that say, look, if we have to cover these additional costs, which are significant, but, you know, in a different way of your point, not all that significant to us, given the economics of these things as we understand them now. Mm-hmm. Now, and again, that's another thing.
Yeah, it's all pretty.
That could all go to hell quickly, I guess. You know, why wouldn't you want to thin your market? And, you know, I was arguing this with somebody last night and they weren't buying it. So I'm not saying this is the right or even the smartest thing in the world. But in terms of, you know, if you're a Google or an Amazon or one of the other big players that have less brand recognition, and it, within this new regime, some of these smaller players are either going to die or be bought out.
Yeah.
You know, that's all right with you.
Yeah.
Right. And so it just becomes, you know, what, you know, if you assume a mode of regulation, you know, how well positioned are you to engage in that set of rules? And I think, you know, maybe in the best of all possible worlds, of course, you would socialize as many, all of your costs if you could. But if the costs that you can't socialize are reduced, but you get something on the other end, which is, you have fewer competitors in this space, you know, maybe that comes out in the, you know, maybe that work, the numbers work out and maybe they don't.
Yeah.
But if you assume that you're going to have to deal with this regulatory environment anyway, in some form or another, there are worse solutions than this, particularly if you're already experiencing local governments just telling you no.
Right.
Right. If the alternative, if the options are
really
no or my costs go up.
Yeah.
You know, if you're, if you think you need to do this anyway and the economics there, if it shrinks your margin a little bit, but maybe you make it up somewhere else, then,
yeah,
you know, why not?
It's sort of like, I can't help but think of like Amazon, which is, you know, Amazon goes and is, you know, selling books. And then all of a sudden, because of the nature of what it requires to sell books, you all of a sudden are like creating all the pipes that make the internet work.
Yeah, right.
And then you just own this thing and it's this whole part of your business, right?
Now on Amazon, you have to dig to find a book.
Right, but they ended up being the infrastructure provider for a lot of other things that becomes a huge part of the business, right? And so to your point, like that is the case, you know, to the extent that governments create, you know, barriers to entry that, you know, maybe, and this is sort of one of the ongoing questions, which sort of walk these data centers up almost to being like quasi utilities, or in some cases, maybe even partial, you know, almost utilities in terms of the subsidization and incorporation into infrastructure as already exists, blah, 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 right? But if you can do that and it's the big businesses that are doing, they get to reap the rewards and they're looking 10 years, 20 years down the line or whatever.
Yeah.
Sure. You say whatever. We'll pay for the pipes, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. The time horizon thing in terms of the logic of the firm and how sensitive you are to additional regulatory costs or whatever is part of that. But probably getting to, you know,
well, no,
over
but
our skis.
But what this raises, I mean, again, I think it raises the same issue, which is, you know, what you're talking about here is you're talking about an industry and speculations that are so astronomical.
Yeah.
That when you start to think about like, well, you know, what is an extra $1 billion in infrastructure? And you're like, well, now you're kind of just talking these weirdo hypotheticals. And what are we talking about in the 5-year time span or 10-year horizon when we're talking about these changes in technology, which like nobody has a full grasp on yet?
Well, this is also why I wanted to break these into short term and long term.
Yeah.
We've kind of bled into the way in that, you know, in the short term, the signaling here from Abbott's perspective, you know, however all that sorts out downstream.
Yeah.
And I would take the, you know, your point well that, you know, this is, you know, an opening gesture. And the reason I kind of framed it in this short-term thing is, you know, in the next 6 to, you know, between now and the end of the year, let's just say, you know, what are the returns and what are, you know, what is the tactical advantage that Abbott gains from doing this?
Yeah.
Right. And it helps Republicans in these fall elections in an area or potentially where they need help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we started talking about the Republican convention. It speaks to some of the concerns of that are going to come up at the convention on this front. That also intersects another policy area that, you know, we talked about how sprawling this is. Another thing that's really brewing out there that is connected to this in some ways is this ongoing fight over building these big 765, people in the business are calling the 765 lines, these big transmission lines being built across the street to feed power needs in the Permian Basin, which is all about oil and gas, speaking of sprawling.
Speaking of big.
Right? A matter of significant dispute with a lot of interesting alignments going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Texas Public Policy Foundation really going to the wall against the building of these lines, the property rights folks, which does intersect a lot of rural people and rural people with money, frankly, not liking this. Texoga, you know, put out a memo either this morning or yesterday. I think it was this morning, once again, today's inbox. Actually, it was last night, saying, hey, this TPPF report saying these things are a bad idea is like wrong, basically. TPPF already firing back, saying, oh, this guy, you know, all that kind of stuff going on, right? But that's another reason for the governor to start.
Yeah, they don't need this.
Engaging in this, right? Because that's all intra-coalitional
stuff. Yeah, they don't need this.
Right? And so the governor has to start refereeing that, and Greg Abbott wants to referee those things.
Yeah.
He wants to do it from a governance perspective. He wants to do it from a political perspective. He wants to do it from a, you know, maintaining the financial base of the party perspective, right? Don't want this getting out of hand, right? You've already got, you know, the trial lawyers with a booth at the Republican convention, all of which, you know, when you step back, is pretty interesting. It maybe makes the convention thing again more interesting. But But it's, I think it is vital in the immediate term, whatever the long-term policy play out is going to be, whatever, however the governance process or the governance results unfold, that the governor wants to send signals right now. He wants to send signals to these elite sectors we're talking about, you know, sending a very direct message to the regulatory apparatus saying, hey, this is what I want, guys that I appointed.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I expect you to read between the lines.
Yeah. I think he's saying it's also not so subtle message to the county officials who are dealing
with to the local government, you know. What? So it's a bit, you know, I mean, so I think the short term thing is, look, I'm here now. I'm hearing this.
And I think one thing, you know, just we haven't mentioned it, but, you know, it's not as though this isn't some easy issue for the Democrats, right? It's not as though, and I think, and this is also one of those instances yet again that shows the strategic disadvantage that Democrats are perpetually at in Texas, which is Abbott can go, release a letter, ultimately set a direction and a course for the conversation that is going to be, if not largely followed, it's going to be the point of deviation for some people. And the Democrats have no similar way to even enter the conversation, really, at this point.
I can't say I've looked, but, you know, I wonder what the Hinojosa campaign's position on this is.
Yeah, I have to look.
But, I mean, that speaks to another kind of broader point we can come back to before we wind this up. But, you know, there's also this medium-term piece. We've kind of dwelled on these other things. But, you know, the fact that there's in June of the non-legislative year, we've got the governor sending the legislature, you know, directives is too strong a word.
Yeah.
But signals for what he thinks the legislature ought to work on.
Yeah.
Also speaking to these party fights, also, you know, another way of, you know, setting the tone. I mean, there are lots, you know, we kind of mentioned it when I was reading from the memo, lots of connections between what he's saying the regulatory bodies should be doing now and what kind of follow-up he expects from the legislature or would desire from the legislature. And again, classic Abbott.
Yeah.
Right? Does not want to cede leadership. And remember, the background of this is, you know, he and Patrick were pretty at odds in the immediate response to grid failures. And remember, one of the biggest signs of that was Abbott, you know, calling for the heads of, you know, the people at ERCOT and the PUC commissioners. And we saw a big turnover at the PUC right after that.
Right.
And that was, in you know, an artifact of that.
Patrick calling for that.
Yes, yeah, Patrick calling for that. And so that's, you know, and that was, you know, that was only one step removed from, you know, open conflict with the governor.
Right.
Right. And there were moments of open conflict with the governor during that. And so, you know, as has come up, I mean, you know, there are a lot of big picture things that make this so interesting. Right, and I think we're probably better positioned to talk about this than the actual policy stuff. But I mean, you know, as you raised, you know, this whole idea of the state preemption of local authority raised a good point in the counties in terms of, you know, where there are gaps in authority, the presumption now in Texas, certainly under this governor, is that the state is going to fill that gap or at least going to try. Whether it's the governor through executive authority, the legislature through assertion of state authority that, you know, tends to accrue to the governor, you know, that's a big thing at work here.
You know, one thing I'll just add as we wrap up, you know, I was talking to a reporter about this subject before they were going to cover the convention. And I said, you know, we don't have a ton of polling on this yet, partially because I know from the polling that it exists, it's not a super salient issue for the public. It's raising and we're going to have some more.
It's ripening as we speak.
But I said, you know, but if you see, and this was actually before Abbott made the letter, but I said, but if you see Abbott make a pretty clear statement on this, I'll tell you something. He's got data.
Yeah.
He knows where this issue is with the voters. He is not someone who's, you know, putting his finger up and kind of thinking, I think I'll do it. Like, they're sophisticated. So my suspicion is that, you know, not to say that they're following the polling or whatever, but like, look, they know what the attitudes look like among their electorate, amongst the voters they need to mobilize moving forward and have considered that.
Yeah.
And crafting this.
You know, this whole, you know, it's interesting that, you know, it's like, oh, you're just following the polling. I mean,
yeah, I don't mean that. Anyway.
I know you don't, but I mean,
okay,
it's
good.
Funny that people, you know, like say that, like, oh, you know, it's just pandering. Look, it's amateur hour if you're not looking at public opinion data on big policy areas. Like, yeah. It's just crazy, right, to think that people would not.
And we know that Abbott has the resources and the interest and the consistent engagement with research so that when you see, again, an issue like this and you see, a clear kind of statement from him, it's not without some support that it's a good move.
Yeah, it's at least part of the calculation.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Again, something that kind of came up in the earlier discussion, but I think in the longer term and how, as we watch the bigger, widen the aperture again and the bigger changes going on in the state and, not even changes, what the dynamics are. The politics of economic growth in the state. We have polled on people's comfort level with growth, whether growth is good or bad for the state, how it's affecting them, what the trade-offs are.
Yeah.
And this is, in some ways – we have put the immigration issue in this frame, but this is a very direct, this is very directly connected to that.
Yeah.
Right. And it does go back. This is also one of the short-term factors, right? Because one of the ways that when state officials have tried to separate themselves from national politics, and this is particularly true of Greg Abbott, and successfully, the argument is, you may think whatever you do about Republicans, about the other guys on the ticket, about the president, about of either whatever, but one thing I'll tell you is that in Texas, we're growing the economy. This is the prosperity state.
Right.
Right. Complicated.
Complicated.
Complicated here, right? Very this is a very complicated issue to be deploying that argument, particularly at a time of economic, localized economic sensitivity to prices, right? Or I shouldn't even say localized, general economic sensitivity to prices that are don't really have anything to do with this necessarily, but it's why the utility bill piece of this is really useful.
Yeah. It's a challenge when, you can't point to like thousands of new jobs. Right. But and what you can point to is, an increased tax base, which an increased tax base for a local government entity that's likely been vilified at one point or another, either generally or specifically by state government that said these guys, if they have a budget problem, that's because they're profligate and they've, they're not balancing the books and where's their audit and all. And it's like, okay, but that's the whole trick here is we're not talking about economic growth in the way that we're normally thinking about it here with these. It sort of enters in a different.
Yeah,
angle,
I mean,
and who had benefits?
I've not followed these campaigns that closely, but I do suspect that in some of these, it kind of goes back to the lag, the development planning, development growth lag, or the differential, trajectories of those that in some of these exurban areas that have been growing really rapidly. And now are becoming, site candidates for these big developments with all of the policy implications that there aren't, and maybe I've just lived in Austin too long, but that there aren't some people that just kind of reflexively go, that is not good growth.
Yeah.
Period.
Well, and, to your point, we've asked questions about population growth specifically in Texas. And I mean, one of the things that was sort of notable during, that period, and we're still growing pretty rapidly. I mean, just to set that aside.
Just less rapidly than we were. Hot growth.
Yeah. But even when that was going on, we asked, is this a good thing or a bad thing for the state? Is it a good thing, a bad thing for your local community? I mean, there's a pretty big partisan gap between Republicans and Democrats, and that with Republicans much less positively disposed towards growth.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. We had a put a pin in that.
Yeah, I think so too.
So there's a lot of things. And then, to end on a down, I don't know, whatever, on too familiar or no, but there's also the internal balance of powers between the branches and between, local government and state government in Texas, centralization, decentralization dynamic that, we've become accustomed to it.
Yeah.
And, I don't want to overplay the fact that, governors in Texas have, always tried to lead. But the last couple of governors have increased the governor's actual capacity to do that.
Right.
And, it's become an article of faith to be more mindful, certainly during the Abbott term, mm-hmm. of just, you know, how conscious the governor is of making sure that he appoints people that are, you know, I don't want to insult anybody, you know, that are more pliant.
Yeah.
Right? And exercising a degree of command and control over his appointees.
Yeah. Let's say, you know, the appropriate mixture of ideologically aligned and pliant were not.
Yeah. And, you know, sheer just, you know.
Yeah.
And that's in the air right now.
Yeah.
Right? So just, we are in an area of assertive executives.
Right.
Shall we say. Right. So all of that is kind of, you know, in the, that's one of the things that I think really kind of made me want to try to muddle through this a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense that, you know, for all the sprawling policy domain, it's also something that is slots into and connects with a lot of big structural things in the longer term and at a broader level.
Well, you brought up the Abbott-Patrick relationship on this. It'll be interesting to see how that comes out. I mean, I think in that article I mentioned, you know, Senator Betancourt was very clear in saying he thought there should be statewide rules for this, which is very on brand for him. Yeah. And I mean, one of the questions kind of going, and I think, you know, even, so two things, you look at Abbott's letter, it says, I want the PUC to do this, and then I want you guys to codify it, right? And I think what'll be interesting to see, first of all, as we know, you know, executives always want the legislatures to do things, and we'll see what that looks like. I think one of the things that I'm definitely going to be keeping an eye on is, you know, how close do Patrick and Abbott and whoever is sort of tasked in the Senate, especially with this, how close do they look on this, and are there any major areas of disagreements and stuff? Because right now, again, we've just seen the one side of this. And maybe everybody, maybe they all talked. Maybe everybody's on the same page, but I don't know yet.
Yeah, well, Speaker Burroughs was on social media this morning applauding this.
That sounds right.
You know, I mean, in an interesting way, it's like, yeah, you know, kind of SB6 was a good start, but, you know, we obviously got more work to be done. It's like, okay, you guys seem pretty satisfied with that last time.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, to be fair to them, I mean, it's not the first or the last time that, you know, the legislature manages to kick out some kind of big policy like this, and they always have to revisit them. Right. So I'm not beating up on the speaker on that. But to the point of the governor's ability to assert leadership, your point about, you know, the degree to which they are together or not together, again, go back to the convention thing. First time, the Downey article said first time ever, and I was trying to remember, I guess, I can't say this is wrong, but I was surprised. First time a Republican speaker has actually addressed the Republican convention.
Yeah, well.
Right? So you've got all, and so, which means automatically the first time the big three have all spoken at the Republican convention.
Yeah.
And, you know, to my, you know, overly dismissive view of the convention that I admitted going in, you know, that's not nothing. You know, that's something.
Yeah, three guys who think they might not get booed.
There's something to read into that.
Yeah, no, for sure.
You know, so.
And that would be, I mean, look, and honestly, if the speaker, the lieutenant governor, and the governor can all go up before that crowd and not one of them get booed, that's pretty notable.
Right.
I mean, look, we're writing something right now. To follow up the podcast last week about 2026 and 2018. And one of the things that we mentioned on that podcast that kind of comes out of this is, you know, yeah, leadership is hard and we see a little bit less intensity and approval of the leaders, although still similar levels of support. But what that's also paired with is greater intensity of favorability among Republicans towards their own party.
Right.
So, I mean, that's one of those things that we always say, you know, while Trump may, you know, make the left go apoplectic and is clearly turning off a lot of independents, a lot of the stuff he's focusing on and a lot of the stuff that the party has followed on and Abbott has followed him on, you know, these are agenda items on the Republican wish list.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's sort of floating around out there is to the extent that they've been more aggressive in going after policies that they say that they want, you know, you should expect the partisans to be a little bit
I'll put it this
happier.
Way, for the people that have stuck with the brand, they like the brand more for it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so, you know, this is going to play into that dynamic. A lot going on here. Again, if you're listening, you're in this space, you want to send us some stuff.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
We made mistakes here, which I'm almost certain we did. You know, please send us your views, send us your stuff, send us your data, and we'll be glad to have it because I'm pretty sure this is going to come up again. So, Josh, thanks for being here today. As always, thanks again to our excellent production team here in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin, who, you know, did not consent to being part of a focus group, but there you go. Thanks for that, too. And, of course, thanks to you for listening. So you can find supporting data, the data we've referenced, much more at our website. Again, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. I believe we are taking the week off next week as we move into a little bit of a summer schedule. But we should be back the week after with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.